Welcome back to Behavioral Science for Brands, a podcast where Richard and I use behavioral science to inform marketers and brand leaders on how they can improve their brands and make more effective marketing based on behavioral science. Today, we're featuring Red Bull. We're talking cans, premium pricing, and the danger of listening to your consumer's opinion too much. I'm Michael Aaron Flicker.
And I'm Richard Shotton.
Let's get into it. So Richard, Red Bull is really a very interesting brand. It comes from Thailand, where it was an original recipe back in the 70s, designed for truck drivers and people that were needing energy for all night. And when the founder originally discovers and tastes the product, he says, I think this is something that could be used outside of Thailand. Fast forward to today, Red Bull is sold in over 170 countries, 8 billion cans a year. It's really an unbelievable powerhouse. They control around 40% of the entire energy drink market globally. So this is a big brand that's known for big advertising, big marketing. It's a very profitable product, so they spend a lot to promote it. And because of that, there's lots of material for you and I to look at as we start to really dig in and understand the brand. So we saw lots of examples of behavioral science. What's one of them that we wanted to highlight today?
I think one of the most interesting points is when they market tested it, when it's moving out of Thailand, coming to Western markets, many of the samplers fed back negatively. They said it was a weird taste. It left a sticky feeling in the mouth. What most brands would have done at that moment is change the formulation and made it much more suitable for Western palates. They didn't do that. And I think they were right not to change the recipe, because Red Bull is a functional drink. It is there to keep you awake, to give you wings. And in many areas, we believe in trade-offs. So if it tastes bad, the belief is probably going to be, well, it must be pretty potent. Now, this idea of trade-offs in food is not speculation. There's a lovely study from Ragunathan, who's at McCombs Business School, I think it's University of Texas. And for his study, he lays on a buffet of Indian food, lots of different elements, gets people to sample all the different elements and ask them, he asks them later to feedback on how much they liked each part of the buffet. He's only interested in one data point though, the mango lassi. So a lassi is a yogurt drink, and sometimes he describes that yogurt drink as being a health drink, other times as an unhealthy drink. When he looks at the ratings between the two groups, there is a massive variation. People rate the drink 55% higher if they think it's unhealthy. Ragunathan's argument is partially we taste what we expect to taste. Mm-hmm. So if you're told something's healthy, you assume it's not going to be great tasting, because often the things that we really enjoy are full of fat,
sugars.
And, yeah. Exactly. You think it won't be so nice tasting, and that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You go and look for evidence to prove that assumption. Whereas if you're told it's unhealthy, your expectations are set in a different way. You expect it to be really, really tasty. Now, that study, I think, can be applied to Red Bull. Rather than health versus unhealthiness, here, the product tasted bad, and therefore people thought, well, if it tasted bad, their claims about giving it energy, their claims about this being real medicinal boost must be true.
The potency must be correct.
Exactly.
And you know, when they talk about what's in Red Bull, it's not just caffeine. It's caffeine, taurine, and B vitamins. It makes you, just hearing it makes you think, well, this has got to have a potent taste if it's going to be effective.
Absolutely. And paradoxically, if they had removed that foul taste, I think they would have and less interest in the product. They're not the only brand, by the way, to have emphasized foul taste. Other functional, not quite drinks, but mouthwashes have done it.
That's what it was my
thought. Listerine, the taste you hate twice a day. Or, and this might not be such a big brand in America, but it's massive in Canada, Buckley's?
No.
Okay, so Buckley's, fascinating story, family-owned brand, tiny brand. It's like 10th in the cough syrup. Market, the owner, Frank Buckley, decides to radically change their advertising, and they just keep on emphasizing how foul it tastes. So the strap line is something along the lines of, it tastes awful and it works. There's another ad that says, our largest bottle is 250 milliliters. You know, anything larger would be cruel.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Within a few years, they have shot up in terms of market share. They're the number one player. They are not spending as much as some of the big brands, yet they have cemented that position. And it's a phenomenally well-known brand in Canada. So again and again, we've seen brands think about taste, I think, in a sophisticated way, recognizing that actually sometimes admitting a flaw in the product, admitting a weakness like bad taste, can be effective if you can link that to another benefit, either potency
yep.
in terms of Red Bull or efficacy in terms of a cough syrup or a medicine.
Yeah, and I think the Listerine example, which we jumped over a little quickly for American markets, yeah. is really compelling because a lot of the current campaigns for Listerine are people swishing it in their mouth, showing the intensity of the flavor. I wouldn't say they look uncomfortable, but it's certainly not a overly pleasant experience. And in showing that swishing in the mouth and the counting until 15 before you spit it out, they're really showing that it must be working. In my knowledge of teeth care, I'm not sure mouthwash is high on the list. Brushing and flossing are what yeah. they recommend. Mouthwash is really an optional step, they say, to fight gingivitis, but really it mitigates bad breath, I think, is the number one use of it.
Yeah. It's interesting how often this comes up in medicine. And this one isn't a experiment or a definitive case, but there is I think it's Jerry Della Femina, who was an ad exec in the 70s. He talks about in his autobiography, a antiseptic cream that supposedly stung when it was put on, and they'd worked out how to remove the sting. But the advice was, don't get rid of the sting, because if you take the sting away, you remove people's belief that it's actually potent. So I think Red Bull, Listerine, Buckley's, they're all applying a very, very counterintuitive but powerful idea. Sometimes weaknesses and problems have mirror benefits. And if you remove the problem, you can sometimes undermine your strength.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll dive deeper into Red Bull and we'll talk about another innovative thing they've done to help premiumize the brand.
Behavioral Science for Brands is brought to you by Method One. Method One builds digital-first marketing systems that help brands grow. They are behavior change experts who solve business challenges by creating meaningful connections with consumers, with deep disciplines in many brand categories. Reach out to them if you'd like to be leveraging behavioral science in your marketing or advertising.
Welcome back to Behavioral Science for Brands. We're talking Red Bull, Richard. And, you know, we were talking in the break about how Red Bull really has a pretty premium perception here in America, but that's not the way it is in Thailand. Originally created as a potent drink to help people doing manual jobs, bricklaying, cement laying, or late night truck driving, it was really had this medicinal potency to give you energy when you needed it most. Bring it out of Thailand and into the Western market. They start in Austria, I think.
Yeah.
In Austria, and then they expand over Europe and then into America, to the United States, but with a very different package. And a very different price point. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
The price is fascinating because if you go back to when they launched, it's worth reminding ourselves of what a tricky task they had. They're not just trying to break into any category. They're trying to break into soft drinks, Coca-Cola, Pepsi. These are huge marketing entities that have a real lock and grasp on that and that market. So to not only launch successfully and to charge a massive price premium versus those competitors, that is a huge achievement. Now, paradoxically, what I think they did that helped them, and Rory Sutherland talks about this brilliantly, is they reduced the size of the can. Now, they don't sell in a 330 milliliter can like
it's 250.
Absolutely. So it's a smaller can and it's differently shaped. It's not squat, it's tall. That's important because there is a broad theme of behavioral science when it comes to pricing, that we don't weigh up how much we're prepared to pay for a product by looking at its inherent values and how much it benefits us. But instead we think, what's a similar item? How much do I pay for that? And then if this new item is better, I'll pay a little bit more. If the new item is worse, I'll pay a little bit less. So if they'd launched in a 330ml can that looked like Coke.
Soda can,
yes. People would have said, well, 75 cents, is that roughly what a Coke charges? 75% is a fair amount for Coke. Maybe because this thing has so much caffeine, I'll pay 80 cents. Paradoxically, you put it into a completely different shaped size and shape can. People forget that the comparison set is Coke and Pepsi. Suddenly, you are let loose of any of these anchors, any of these comparisons. And therefore, you're free to charge whatever you want. And they went for a significant price premium. Mm. I think in the UK, they were charging at least double from memory when they launched. And that is a insight from behavioral science that far more brands, I think, could be applying.
Do you think it also helped that they were not advocating what most soft drinks would say is refreshing, and they were kind of creating a new category? I mean, energy drink was not a massive category, if at all, until they established it. So not only are they trying to break in and steal share of throat from Coke and Pepsi, but they're trying to create a new category as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But my argument would be energy drink and a highly caffeinated drink like Coke aren't completely different. They overlap.
Yes.
So if they had put the drink in a 330ml can, people would have
made that association.
They would have made the association. And yes, because it's slightly different, they might have been able to
accept a little
premium, but I would argue not anything like the degree they did charge. By a different design, and as you say, there is a fundamental difference to the product. Those two things together maybe liberated them and liberated their pricing.
I'm going to speak directly to our US advertising listeners and remind them that marketing is much wider than just the creative that we put into market. Changing the product packaging can be one of the most effective things you can do in order to premiumize a brand, help set it apart in a category. And that's really what Richard's talking about here. The ability to not allow the comparison between Red Bull and soft drinks to be made because it's in a taller, skinnier can, different size. You can't make the math calculation easily from a price perspective. And I think that we want to remind everyone that there's a lot more tools at our disposal than just making an ad campaign, than just making a commercial.
Absolutely. And I think it's somewhere where we've actually gone backwards as an industry. In the 1950s and 60s, ad agencies had huge input in end products, but we've progressively become badged into a smaller role of creating, you know, hopefully beautiful imagery. The danger is if you see that as the only tool at your disposal, you are leaving out many other mechanisms to change customer behavior.
And I think whether you work at a traditional ad agency or at a marketing consultancy, the role of all of us is to think about the end consumer, what their needs are, and how we can best deliver it. And as brand leaders, people that engage agencies, we know the best ideas can come from anywhere. So even if agency X makes commercials, if they have the insight that could potentially help the brand, then we can go and get someone else to do it. But they get the credit for saying, what if we weren't being compared with soft drinks? What if we could change that base association? It gives you a real chance to change the trajectory of the brand.
Definitely.
So Richard, as we like to do, we like to wrap each episode with the key points of today's discussion.
We've discussed three broad things. Firstly, the power of weaknesses. If you have a weakness with your product, make sure, like bad taste, make sure you consider whether there is a mirror strength.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know from those studies, by people like Raghunathan, that often people assume that, in the case of Red Bull, a bad taste leads to being more potent. So think about whether there is a counterintuitive approach of emphasizing some of those problems. The second thing we discussed was another counterintuitive idea, which is around pricing. that people don't behave like rational calculating machines. They don't just look at the benefits that you bring and then work out a fair price to pay. They are very, very influenced by the mental comparison set they hold. So if you can shift that mental comparison set, you can shift willingness to pay. In the case of Red Bull, it was breaking the association with soft drinks like Pepsi and Coke and instead setting up a new category. And then the third and final point that we've kind of touched on a little bit, but which definitely unites the pricing and the bad taste examples, is the danger of listening to simplistic market research. If you just go out and ask people directly what you should do with your product, they'll tell you to price it fairly. They'll tell you to make it taste nice. They'll tell you lots of things which should influence us, but in reality actually aren't necessarily effective. So I think have a healthy skepticism to what customers claim in research and think more about running simple experiments or pilot tests instead.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. For those that were listening, questions that you have, comments that you want to leave, by all means, reach out to Richard and I. Richard, we like to always end on a fun note. We talked about Red Bull's beginning in Thailand. Do you have a favorite Thai dish that you enjoy?
Oh, my go-to staple would be, I think, Thai green curry.
Oh, yeah. Thai green curry.
Yeah.
Delicious. Delicious. And for me, Pad See Ew, which is a wide egg noodle, often made with chicken or could be with vegetables. Very tasty.
Very nice. Very nice.
Wonderful. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Until next time, I'm Michael Aaron Flicker.
And I'm Richard Shorten.